Hello, I'm Peter Donat. As the title of this series implies, throughout the ages there have been transformations of mythic forms which stand as significant signposts in our historical record. As a forerunner to today's complex world, the emergence of city civilizations in the Neolithic period marks the beginning of a crucial stage in the development of humanity. It is a period of time in which the goddess, venerated as a symbol of fertility and creativity, bestowed her life-giving grace on a new order of society. Campbell asserts that during this period, among all the fundamental arts of high civilization taking root, none was more important than the systematic observations of the heavens. With the recognition of a predictable cosmic order came the imposition on earthly affairs of a divine law from above. And so the prayer, in one form or another, echoes through the ages. Thy will be done on earth as it is done in heaven.
Now what I want to talk about this afternoon is the next great stage. The stage of the emergence of the city civilizations in the Near East, and we get into the historic processes. A remarkable thing happens in certain places, at certain times. Namely, the timeless idol of the nature religions yields to a temporally ordered process so that civilizations emerge that have histories, a youth, a maturity, and an aging. And we'll see where we are on this cycle. The most important representation of this in literature is in Oswald Spengler's Untergang des Abendlandes, The Decline of the West, where he indicates eight civilizations that have gone through cycles and indicates exactly where we are. And this is what I want to enter upon this afternoon. There are three main centers that have been recognized as matrices of origin of agriculture and the domestication of animals. They are Southeast Asia, which is recently being recognized as probably the earliest center, but probably the earliest center. Then Southwest Asia. Now the center should include Asia Minor and Southeast Europe. Very important center. And the third center, of course, is Middle America, Mexico, and Peru. From this very important section, the high culture cities and writing and high mathematics develop. Here, the principal agriculture is of grains, and the animals domesticated are cattle, and then later the horse, and in the Syro-Arabian desert area then, the dromedaries, the camel. I'm going to start here in South Turkey, Anatolia, as it's called, a little town called Çatalhöyük. There was a very important series of excavations here conducted by James Mellart. With this, the antiquity of planting cultures in the Near East was lowered down to about 10,000 B.C. Here is the plain where Çatalhöyük is situated. Here is the kind of village you have. It reminds me a little bit of the Pueblo. Houses what, right, packed on each other. To take such a town by storm, you have to tear the buildings down. There's no way to get into the town except by way of the buildings themselves. And there are some 15 levels of these buildings at Çatalhöyük. This is one of the most important and oldest finds, and it is the key symbol of the main mythology of this area. Here you have the mother goddess back to back with herself. Here on the left, she is embracing an adult male, and here on the right, she holds a child. She is the transformer. Here we have our mother goddess in the center, where you have agriculture at the base. The goddess is going to be the primary mythological figure, personifying the energies of nature which transform past into future, transforming semen into child, seed into produce and so forth. This is a small piece made of a green schist and found from a date 7,000 B.C. This figure was found in a grain bin, and so it's associated with agriculture. It's a ceramic piece. It is of the goddess seated between two felines. You remember our association of the lion with the goddess? Having given birth, that's the head of a child. This is the goddess giving birth, and we can date this 7 to 6,000 B.C. And now I'm going to take you to Rome, 100 A.D., the Anatolian goddess. And Anatolia is exactly the place from which this figure, the earlier figure, has come, flanked by lions, seated on a throne, the sun disk in her hand, and on her head, the crown, the walled city. Here the city has arisen. During the Carthaginian Wars, the cult of this Anatolian goddess was brought into Rome as one of the supporting powers to support the Roman cause. So here we have 6,000 years of this goddess. Going back to Châtelherault, there have been found a number of little chapels there, and a great number of little chapels. And in one of them, associated with the goddess, we have this figure of two facing leopards. These are the threshold gold guardians, the male and female leopard. Now, I want to call your attention to the spots on this leopard, which have trefoil, three leaf forms in them. We'll just hold that in mind for recollection later. The wall that defends the sanctuary has these two guardian figures, and the leopards have spots with the trefoil. Here is a typical little shrine room. This is a form of the goddess that's called by the excavators the birth-giving form. And what she has given birth to here is not a human child, but the bull. The bull, now we have no writing from this period. The bull, later, is associated with the moon, as I've already seen. The moon dies and is resurrected and is born again from the solar goddess. Here is undoubtedly the happy father. These I find very exciting, these bull horn cores in adoration of this mystery. So we have her giving birth in the grain bin figure to a human form, and here to the symbolic Bucranium, the bull. This is a fascinating chapel. Here is the bull's head, the returning moon, and under it is a skull. We've already spoken about the skull cult. Here on the wall is a vulture eating back a body that is without a head. The head has been removed. It is here. The body is returned to Mother Earth or Mother Sky. The vulture is the consuming aspect of the goddess who gives birth. The body is therefore recycling, as we would say today. If you were to translate into words the sense of this little shrine with the skull here, it would be, O goddess mother or whatever, as the moon is reborn, so may I, my mortal body, be returned to the source. This is from Jericho, from about 6 to 5,000 B.C. The excavations in Jericho, conducted under the supervision of Kathleen Kenyon, just about the time that Mallart was working in Châtelherault, those two works together lowered the threshold for the origins of agriculture in the Near East. Again on the wall, one of these vulture murals consuming the bodies from which the head, which contains apparently the consciousness, have been removed. This is from the tomb of Ramses IV in Egypt. This vulture goddess, her name is Nekhbet in Egypt. The whole ceiling of this tomb are reproductions of the goddess Nekhbet, who eats back. And so we have a cult here that is certainly 6,000 or 7,000 years of duration. Now we've been talking about Asia Minor, Shatahuyuk down here. I want to move to Southeast Europe. The past 30 years or so, a tremendous amount of material has been excavated here. And there is a magnificent study of these materials by a woman who is in the faculty of the University of California in Los Angeles. Her name is Maria Gimbutas, G-I-M-B-U-T-A-S. Her book is called Gods and Goddesses of Old Europe, 7,000 to 3,500 B.C. This is very, very early stuff. And it's a period when the mother goddess is dominant. And I just want to run rather briefly, or rapidly, let me say, through a great series of the images associated with this area here, northern Greece principally, the Balkans, and the areas around the Danube, Dnieper, Dniester, and even a little bit the Volga. Here is a very early 6,000 BC representation of the goddess. And there are a number of traits here that are essential. One is the towering neck. This is the world axis. She is the axis. Here is the bird figure on the top of the neck. She is bird goddess, spiritual goddess. Obviously a human female with the breasts. Here associated with her is the boar. Here is a pig goddess and the labyrinth. Ceramic serpent, all of the same order. Here is another enthroned goddess, broken, but the labyrinth and the navel, the world navel, that which connects to the mother. This is a very interesting business. These little pellets have inscriptions on that. It looks almost like a swastika. But what about all this? And here on the inside of this bowl, where we have this indication, there is what looks like a linear script. If it is, this is the earliest writing in the history of civilization. Date 5,000 B.C. The date usually given for the origins of writing is about 3,200 B.C. in Mesopotamia, ancient Sumer. But if this can be validated, we may have an earlier dating for writing in Europe. This is a male figure in the way of a ruler. Over his shoulder is a scepter in the shape of a reaping sickle. Here is a sickle of copper from that date, 5,000 B.C. So these are agricultural people harvesting a grain of some kind. Their tools are not weapons. These are heavy copper tools, and they are used for carpentry and or agriculture. These are peaceful cities. It's only later that the walls begin appearing that indicate raids coming in from outside. And we're approaching with these walls then the whole history, later history of the Near East. Planting people in high mountain valleys and later in the great river valleys, Tigris, Euphrates, and Nile. And then barbarians raiding in from the desert and great plains. Two orders of barbarians. One, the Semites, from the Syro-Arabian desert, raiding in from the south. The others, the Indo-Europeans, raiding in from the north. The Indo-Europeans are herders of cattle, and it is they who first domesticated the horse and invented the war chariot, which became an invincible weapon. The Semites were herders of sheep and goats, and they later mastered the camel. And the gods are of two orders, really. Those that represent the powers of nature, which operate in the universe and within ourselves, and then those that are the specific patrons of the tribe. In most mythologies, the tribal patron deities are secondary to the nature deities. In Semitic mythologies, the role is reversed. We'll try to think of why later, but this is quite characteristic. Now you see the early Minotaur. This is around 4,500 B.C. a human head and the bull's body. And here, just the reverse, the human's body and the bull's head. So we have the Minotaur, that is to say, the bull and cattle as a principal deity, just as the bison among the American Indians. In the beginning, the animal and human forms are mixed, just as they were in the early dancer at Trois Frères. Now we come to about 3,500 to 3,000 and 2,500 B.C. This is from Crete. What in Crete we find is a continuation into the island world of the mother goddess system that had flourished on the mainland. Meanwhile, on the mainland, patriarchal warrior people, herders, are raiding in, and the culture is changing. You have a marginal survival in Crete of the earlier mother goddess systems. There she is, with the labrys, or double axe, which is the prime symbol of Crete. She is not only the one who gives life, she is the one who takes it, the labrys, with lunar suggestions in the form of the blades, dying and resurrecting. Here is a representation on a sarcophagus from Crete of animals for sacrifice. The prime animal is the bull with the horns. The moon must die to be resurrected. The sacred bull is slain, and the young bull then is the resurrection. Underneath here we have goats that are ready for sacrifice as well. Here we have a priest at a sacrificial altar. Now, the bull sacrifice seems to be a substitute for an earlier king sacrifice. Here we see bull games. This is a little mural in the palace at Knossos, in the king's chamber. And there's been a question as to whether this is possible for bull games of this kind, of people leaping over bulls. It's a shorter-legged bull than the Toro Bravo of the Spanish bull ring. And yet it seems an impossible feat. Well, when I was a student in France, I went down to Bordeaux to see a bullfight, where the bull wasn't going to be killed at all. There came into the bull ring a collection of chaps in white duck pants and white shirts with red sashes, two trumpets of triumph greeting them. Most of them were lame from having met the bull in one encounter or another. And after they had saluted the congregation, a young bull was released into the arena with horns like needles. And the thing was to get this bull to run at you and then to step aside, moving only one foot. Well, you can imagine that there were some moments of horror. This was going on very nicely when one of the chaps, when the bull came at him, ran at the bull and jumped right over the bull. So it can be done. It was something to see. Well, after this event, somebody goes out in the ring and says, anybody 16 years older, who wants to come down and play with bulls, come on down. Well, then you had to close your eyes. Here is one of these murals. There are women dancing. I think of them as the girls that dance between halves in a football game. The whole audience here are women. In none of the archaic cultures are women as elegantly prominent as in Crete. There must have been some kind of continuation there of the women's role in the earlier mother goddess culture systems. And now we come to the king's throne. There's a tiny little throne room, and here is the king's throne, and there is the moon that dies to be resurrected, and the king was killed in Crete, possibly once every 8 years, in association with the cycle of the planet Venus. You don't see pictures of old kings in Crete. This is the throne room from a larger perspective, and here on either side, we have a griffin. And where you have women prominent in a cult, there are most likely going to be an accent on what might be called the religious experience rather than on the theological, logical and rational aspect. It's much more the experience accent. So the griffin is somehow associated with the goddess cult here. A tomb ceremony, this being the dead person, this the tomb, and here offerings, this moon boat that carries the soul to the underworld, so forth, offerings of animal sacrifices. And here we have the altar horns, and through them you see Mount Ida, the sacred mountain. Now I just have to make a confession, namely, that these horns were put here by Sir Arthur Evans. But he knew what he was doing. Now we look at the goddess, the horns, and the sacred mountain. She's it, and the birds associated with her. And there, finally, we have our goddess again on the cosmic mountain, and her lions, the feline animal, behind her, the altar horns, and the trident, the way between the pair of opposites, the way to transcendence. I want to move now to the Near East, where the first cities appear, and here's something entirely new. The culture life of a small community or nomadic tribe would be pretty well available to everybody in the community. You would have a community of equivalent adults. The distinctions would be age group distinctions, male and female distinctions, and the distinctions between the normal order of people and the specially gifted shamanic visionaries. But with the enlargement of the communities which followed the establishment of agriculture and the domestication of animals, we begin to have a differentiation of professions. And instead of a culture of what might be called generalists and amateurs, we have professionals. People whose whole life and the whole dynasty of their family are devoted to government or the priesthood or trade or the agriculture. So we have a differentiation of peoples and a new problem, namely to get people of different life forms to experience themselves as member of a single organism. So that's what's disintegrating in our world with the worker against the employer and this against that and so forth and so on. That's a disintegration of a cultural organism. And in the early cultures, the problem was to keep the organization intact. With the professional priesthood, there was a recognition of the passages of the planets through the zodiac of the fixed constellations. These were the people who first invented writing and arithmetic, numeration in terms of the tens and of sixties, the sexagesimal and the reckoning by tens. And we still use sexagesimal for reckoning cycles of time or of space. With writing, mathematics, and precise observation of the heavens, it was possible to determine that the planets were moving at a mathematically determinable rate. So we begin to get an idea of a cosmic order that can be mathematically recorded. This is a whole transformation of culture. Something altogether new and different comes in. In the earlier situations, this peculiar tree, this special pond or rock, the exceptional becomes important. And then the animal that is of most importance, or the plant, and so forth and so on. But now we begin to have the notion of a cosmic order, and the exception is out rather than in. The exception is aberrant. And so we have a totally new kind of way of regarding the universe. And now I'm going to move to the Tigris-Euphrates area. Here is where the earliest cities in the world first appear. The entry into these river valleys occurs somewhere around 4000 BC. About the same time there's an entrance into the Nile Valley as well. The Nile is a kind of oasis area, protected on all sides by desert. Tigris, Euphrates are something quite different. They're wide open, north, south, and east, and west, to invasions. And so, whereas something very stable evolved in Egypt, there were enormous transformations and historical developments in the Tigris-Euphrates area. Among the early finds that we're going to be dealing with are from Halaf, very early pottery, 4000 BC, from Samarra, very early pottery, 4000 BC, Uruk and Al-Ubaid, the very early cities. Now, it's in this period, and in precisely this kind of work, that the notion of an aesthetic field first appears. When we go to the caves, you don't have an aesthetic field. You have a great organization of forms in terms of the structure of the cave and so forth, but you won't have an enclosed area like this. And also, the designs here are more abstract. So abstraction and an aesthetically organized field begins to appear. The pottery here, this is very early pottery, is extremely fine. It's an elegant ceramic period. Here is the bucranium, the bull's head, arranged in such a way as to make a Maltese cross. You can see aesthetic composition and arrangements has become significant. Here now we go to Samarra, and we have a whole constellation of swastika forms. Here the animals going around in counterclockwise fashion. What the swastika represents is the four points of the compass, the cross of the earth in movement. Another Samarra piece, this circulation, this circumambulation motif, and here circumambulating the cosmic tree. Now please notice this, we're going to see it again in a surprising context. The two animals, a kind of a reverse mirror image, sharing a single set of legs. Now this is one of the earliest little temples that has ever been excavated and reconstructed. It's at Al-Ubaid, and it comes from around 3500 BC. Here is an overview of the town, and notice the magnitude of the temple compound. It is in the form of the vagina of a cow. You have the cow goddess, the universe as cow mother. The milk of the cow is the milk of the goddess. And in the compound, there was a herd of sacred cattle. Here you have the priests with the sacred milk of the sacred cattle, and the ruling house would be fed on this, which comes as holy food. These are the same sacred animals that are walking the streets of Calcutta today. There's a continuity here of the cow, Mother Universe, the 4 feet of the cow, the 4 points of the compass, and so forth. The same imagery appears in Egypt.